They have also engaged in greenwashing, supporting fossil-free projects that take traditionally held lands without the consent of local communities and the consent of indigenous peoples, destroying the biodiverse ecosystems they have protected for generations. These institutions have also repeatedly looked the other way and been complicit in human rights violations of corporations and governments they work with. They support activities where armed forces push forward large infrastructure and extractive projects on traditional lands without the participation and consent of indigenous peoples. They indiscriminately fund states where there is corporate capture of institutions, and police and courts violently punish those who speak the truth to power rather than those who murder social justice leaders. For instance, despite warning from local communities in Colombia, several development financiers provided support for the construction of the Hidroituango Dam, which has had a catastrophic impact for the people and the environment, including forced displacement of hundreds of families, loss of livelihoods, floods, landslides, and mass fish kill. In the past 11 years, six members of the grassroots organization Movimiento Rios Vivos and more than 30 other community members have been killed for raising their concerns about the project. Development banks have also supported privatization of essential services, prioritizing growth and corporate profits over protections for workers and communities. And now, in the middle of a pandemic, many people are left without access to healthcare, access to shelter, livelihoods, food, sanitary products, and medicines, even as stock markets rise. However, in the name of crowding, in private investments, development banks are continuing to pump out billions of dollars to bail out corporations during the pandemic, with few safeguards to ensure the money reaches the people who need it the most. Indeed, public development banks have contributed to a world where the 22 richest men in the world have more wealth than all the women in Africa. They have done little to challenge systems through which caregiving falls disproportionately on women, focusing instead on farcical women's empowerment efforts. They have also failed to confront their role in advancing racism and colonialism, or contributing to increased surveillance and securitization, and inhibiting world peace. A better world is possible, even as we reel under the shocks of intersecting crises of the pandemic, climate change and rising inequality, violence and militarization. And a better world can benefit from the right kind of public development finance. But public banks, governments and businesses need to make changes if we want to move away from a world of self-inflicted existential threats. The response to the current crisis of our times cannot be to simply push out more money without considering for the long-term environmental and social impacts of these funds on local communities and on local people and workers. And who better to assess the long-term impact of these investments than communities and workers themselves? The very idea of international development finance has to be reshaped under the leadership of communities who have repeatedly called for the lens of collective responsibility and reparations. The existing models of debt and financial aid focused on states and corporations only serve to replicate colonial power imbalances and support the prevailing top-down paradigm. Instead, people who are the purported beneficiaries of development finance have to be the key decision makers. to make future iterations of the Financing Commons Summit impactful, the first thing the organizers have to do is to recognize communities are the experts of their own development. Community-led development and human rights must be front and center on the summit agenda. Indigenous peoples, grassroots communities, and social movements must be invited to share their vision of development. If governments and their public banks are serious about transformation and leaving behind old patterns of crises, human rights in common have to come before finance in common.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Marisa Cloud, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sends speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film. And I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that You know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking. The rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking?
And yeah.
That it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly, and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version, and we didn't get that. What it has, and what really is its strength, is that the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something, and in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's the strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but I that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd be a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I felt there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. And sort of you were plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay. You know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
That was intentional. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, which I guess if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for the need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. what we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitised version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. Let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love in the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, you know, connected to the people next to you. And that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. they're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, and he says, take your helmet off, yeah. Come and talk to us.
Yeah,
and I'd like to see more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area, or yeah, I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest, and sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, yeah, violence, of course this should happen. It said, well, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
Yeah, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovi so, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what did you think of this sort of ending of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing the mayor and removing the radar cameras. And
some of it seems a bit superficial. Some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. And I felt that the documentary did mention this, that that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. There was someone talking about the social, the community-type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protests? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and I had no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A federal judge in New York has ruled that the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, assumed his position unlawfully and has invalidated Wolf's suspension of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, which shields young people from deportation. The Department of Homeland Security failed to follow the order of succession as it was lawfully designated, the U.S. District Judge Nicholas Graufis wrote. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff writers of the Associated Press. The piece is titled, "Judge Rules DACA Suspension Invalid, Homeland Security Head in office illegally. Stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. A federal judge in New York has ruled that the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, assumed this position unlawfully and has invalidated Wolf's suspension of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program, which shields young people from deportation. The Department of Homeland Security failed to follow the order of succession as it was lawfully designated, the U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garalfis wrote. Therefore, the actions taken by purported acting secretaries who were not properly in their roles according to the lawful order of succession were taken without legal authority. About 650,000 people are part of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which allows young immigrants who were brought to the country as children to legally work and shields them from deportation. Karen Tomlin, an attorney who represented a plaintiff in one of two lawsuits that challenged Chad Wolf's authority, called the ruling another win for DACA recipients and those who have been waiting years to apply for the program for the first time. Chad Wolf issued a memorandum in July effectively suspending DACA pending reviews by the Department of Homeland Security. A month earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that Donald Trump failed to follow rulemaking procedures when he tried to end the program, but the justices kept a window open for him to try again. In August, the Government Accountability Office, GAO, a bipartisan congressional watchdog, said Chad Wolf and his acting deputy, Ken Cuccinelli, were improperly serving and ineligible to run the agency under the Vacancies Reform Act. The two have been at the forefront of administration initiatives on immigration and law enforcement. Chad Wolf is the fifth person to serve as Homeland Security Secretary under President Donald Trump in an acting or confirmed capacity, whilst former Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama each had three people in the job over the course of their two presidential terms. Wolf was named to the post only after two of the President's preferred candidates were ruled ineligible to take up the job. Since being appointed to the role, Chad Wolf has overseen the controversial deployment of federal agents to quell Black Lives Matter protests in Portland, Oregon, as well as denying that there was a problem with systemic racism in U.S. law enforcement. Chad Wolf has also downplayed the threat of COVID-19, whilst overseeing the implementation of extreme immigration restrictions the White House claimed would stem the spread of coronavirus. In U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garalfis' ruling on Saturday, 14th of November, the judge wrote that the Department of Homeland Security did not follow an order of succession established when the then-Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen resigned in April of 2019. Meanwhile, the controversial Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has rejected the notion that the United States has a systemic racism problem with its police. "I do not think that we have a systemic racism problem with law enforcement officers across this country," Chad Wolf recently told ABC's Martha Raddatz on this week's programme. His comments came after protests over police brutality erupted in all 50 states in the United States and around the globe following the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis Police Department officer, Derek Chauvin. Wolf felt that the issue was limited to particular police officers as opposed to a systemic issue. He said that whilst there was room for improvement, painting law enforcement with a broad brush of systemic racism is really a disservice to the men and women who put on the badge, the uniform every day, and risk their lives every day to protect the American people. Chad Wolf said the law enforcement officials that are not doing their job correctly need to be held accountable, pointing towards the charges level that four police officers who were involved in George Floyd's murder. ICE and Border Patrol agents who now work under Wolf at the Department of Homeland Security have faced numerous civil lawsuits for misconduct, such as shooting unarmed migrants as they cross the border and arresting U.S. citizens for immigration purposes.
Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsadun Khattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital Tehran and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said the U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, hailed Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria, from the terrorists of ISIS. The United States was fighting against the fight on terrors, and how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence.
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region, as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction, and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Abiy, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Oromo, not Amhara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause the conflict to spill over into neighbouring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
And the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. December 31st is looming, but the remaining differences are apparently still very significant. The two sides are trying to hammer out an agreement on their future ties that will include a crucial trade deal, security cooperation, and rules in areas like fishing access. The talks are tough, with each side pushing to get the other to make more concessions. Battered by the devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Britain urgently need a trade agreement that would minimize disruption in January when the country officially exits the European trading system. But top EU officials are taking a tough line on Britain and are unwilling to budge. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is widely seen as the final deadline for a draft deal. The situation has piled pressure on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is a key architect of Brexit. He seems to be scrambling to make trade deals with other nations like the United States to make the UK less dependent on a deal with the European bloc. He has used the possibility of clinching trade deals with other countries as a bargaining chip in talks with Brussels. Johnson wants to get the EU to believe that Britain can easily survive even if it leaves the bloc's trading system without a deal. He has long been pinning his hopes on a fast-track free trade deal with America. Boris Johnson was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden soon after media projections showed that he won the presidential race. Critics in Britain and the U.S. have dismissed this as insincere, as members of Johnson's cabinet and Tory lawmakers had openly supported the re-election of the incumbent president. Things will probably be a lot different if Biden takes office in January. Unlike Trump, Biden has made it clear that the withdrawal agreement, which set the stage for Britain's formal departure from the European Union, must be respected. This means Biden doesn't like a no-deal Brexit at all. Meanwhile, Biden speaks very proudly of his Irish roots. He has made it clear that the 1998 U.S. brokered Good Friday peace deal for Northern Ireland must never be violated. That, some believe, is a warning against a bill pushed by Johnson that would violate parts of the EU divorce agreement governing the border with Ireland. Biden's stance may weaken Johnson's position in talks with Brussels.
And we've got a much closer relationship between the Democratic Party and Brussels. So this is going to be bad for Britain, no doubt about it, when it comes into next year. But don't forget, this deal has got to be signed by the end of 2020. And so Trump is still going to be president at that point. When the negotiations are going down the line, that's one of the reasons why I think the European Union will be doing everything it can to make sure there is no deal at the end of the year.
Top EU negotiators know all too well that the balance is changing. The British Premier now has to perform a delicate balancing act. He has to come up with a way to pressure Brussels that does not antagonize Biden. Johnson faces a mammoth task. Is he up to the job? The British Premier faces a race against time, as any agreement has to be ratified by the European and British parliaments before the looming deadline.
The beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued, following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark, was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on, and so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility, though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, Mayor of London, certain government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
Thank you. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Dr. Hadi Isa Dalul, international law and nuclear consultant, says Washington is unable to bring back the UNSC sanctions against Tehran as Moscow and Beijing have adopted their positions against the White House's move. In an exclusive interview with Fars News Agency, Dr. Hadi Isa Dalul said, without passing a UNSC resolution against Iran, the U.S. administration will only be able to take carrot and stick policy, saying, for the countries and the companies which they can threaten, they can go ahead under the table with an unofficial or unethical way. For the countries and companies which they cannot threaten, they need to have promotions which must be related to the level of investment in those countries or companies. Dr. Hadi Isa Dalul is a nuclear physicist who studied at the University of Houston and at Imperial College London. He frequently appears on various international news channels commenting on political affairs in the West Asia region. This interview is published under the heading, Hadi Isa Dalul says, U.S. powerless against Iran at UNSC. Stay tuned, please, for this interview. The U.S. left Iran's nuclear deal some 2 years ago. Is the U.S. technically entitled to force the U.N. members to step down from their responsibilities and commitments to the JCPOA?
Both countries, Russia and China, have enforcement investment in global world, which can push the United States or preventing any new sanctions. Russia and China can go ahead with the same channel they are willing to push the United States through. That is why they have the power. Actually, for the last 4 years, we can see the United States cannot force any country on a resolution as I mentioned in the first answer, by promoting or threatening. That is why it enables China and Russia to push the United States and prevent it from threatening the countries which are related, directly or indirectly, to Russia or China.
The UK, France and Germany said they will support the JCPOA, but Russia and China clearly said they will reject the US's move. How can they prevent the US restructured sanctions to take